This program contains dramatizations. Viewer discretion is advised. In our first story, Behind Mansion Walls, some will do anything to reach the top rung of society.
He wanted to be Mr. Palm Beach.
Even if it means a body at the bottom of the ladder.
To be so greedy, you're willing to kill somebody.
And later, for an aging Palm Beach big shot, a beautiful wife is a must.
Palm Beach millionaire seeks younger woman.
But who's using who?
She wanted to be a member of Palm Beach society.
Just don't break into that circle of folks unless you're one of them.
I'm Christopher Mason. Behind mansion walls, old money and new money sometimes share the same zip code. 33480, Palm Beach, an address to die for.
When money retires, or just wants to play in the sun, it comes here to Palm Beach, Florida.
Where else can you rub shoulders with the Vanderbilts and the Trumps, all in one very white stretch of sand? Palm Beach is Disneyland for billionaires.
I would say wealth would be starting at $100 million. If you want to play the game, if you have less than that, you better stay home.
Jim Sullivan doesn't even have $1 million. But that doesn't stop him from dreaming of moving to America's most prestigious address. It's a long way from the mean streets of Boston, where working class Jim grew up. But he hits the jackpot in 1983. His wealthy uncle dies in Macon, Georgia. And Jim lands a $5 million windfall.
This was newfound money, and he was a newcomer to it. It's more or less like he hit the lottery.
It's chump change by Palm Beach standards, but enough for a makeover from working class to boating class. And with his glamorous wife, Lita, on his arm, Jim might just pass as a high roller. Lita doesn't need to climb the social ladder. She's from a prominent Atlanta family.
Very, very fine people and very influential people in their community.
And she's no gold digger either. She married Jim for love before he got his inheritance.
Lita was madly in love with him. He was very charming. You know, when you first met him, he was quite a charmer.
Lita's friend, Aida Flam, remembers when Jim charmed Lita into moving to Palm Beach.
Lita was not crazy about going to Palm Beach. He was the one that wanted to do it. It was all about Jim.
Jim thinks Lita will be his entree to the social circuit. But first, it's time to find the right address. He hits the streets right away for some mansion shopping. And ends up here.
Jim has chosen well. His grand Italianate mansion was designed and built in the 1920s by Swiss architect Maurice Fatio, the same architect behind the mansions of the Rockefellers.
He just loved the idea of a home, an estate, and the house was on the register as a historic home.
Boston Jim's transformation into Palm Beach James is almost complete.
Look at that. Mm. Definitely look like the power couple.
Mm-hmm. Help him create the person he wanted to be, the person he never was.
Very handsome.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All the way back to the DuPonts and the Rockefellers and people that founded oil companies. Sullivan wanted to be part of that. He thought himself to be in that ilk.
A quick costume change, and at last, everything is in place.
Thank you.
James Sullivan, Palm Beach millionaire, is ready for his debut.
Palm Beach, here we come.
Sullivan wanted to bring himself onto the scene. Palm Beach had a lot of cachet. He thought it brought him the same cachet because he came in with his money, and he just tried to insinuate himself into a wealthy community.
But Palm Beach society gives Sullivan the brush off. They can smell an imposter a golf course away.
It didn't take long for people to figure him out. You just don't break into that circle of folks unless you're one of them.
But Sullivan doesn't blame the closed ranks of the wealthy. He believes the problem is the color of Lita's skin.
He thought that Lita was pulling him back because she was African American. That caused problems, I guess, in their social climbing.
Sullivan starts looking around for a new partner, perhaps someone more befitting Palm Beach in his eyes.
He was a cheat. He cheated on his wife, he cheated on girlfriends, he cheated whenever he could.
When Lita uncovers her husband's betrayal, she packs her bags and heads home to Atlanta, Georgia. In 1985, after 8 years of marriage, she files for divorce.
She'd gone back to Atlanta to be closer to her family and just proceed with a divorce.
Meanwhile, Sullivan sets his sights on another Palm Beach beauty. This time, he's sure he's found the right girl to usher him into society. Suki Rogers.
She's a platinum pass to the Palm Beach inner circle. From drinks at the Everglades Club to dinner at Club Colette, it looks like James has finally hit the big time.
He's attempting to get more into society. He thinks because he's with an exotic woman that everybody thinks he's some dashing, debonair dude. But he's just still same old Sullivan.
Sullivan intends to marry his new love, and the couple cuts dashing figures on the Palm Beach circuit. But he has some old business to attend to. And that's not the only pressure on Sullivan's finances. After an expensive legal battle, the divorce settlement with his first wife, Lita, is about to be finalized. And she stands to gain half his assets. Sullivan is not happy.
He was not going to relinquish anything to her. He didn't believe she deserved anything.
He was cheap. There's frugal and then there's cheap. He was cheap. He would take the napkins from the restaurants and bring them home. He was just cheap.
The settlement date is set for January 16th, 1987. But as Lita prepares for the hearing, there's a knock at her door that is about to change everything. Life is looking up for Boston transplant Jim Sullivan. He's finally found a ticket into Palm Beach High Society with a new partner. And they're living it up together on the island of billionaires, Palm Beach.
James Vincent Sullivan is not so much a self-made man as a made-up man. His roots are blue-collar Boston. But after a rocky start, he's convinced some people he's a Palm Beach blue blood.
For his ex-wife, Lita, there also seems to be a light at the end of the tunnel. She's preparing for the final divorce hearing at her home in Atlanta when there's a knock at the door.
She probably thought it was a friend of hers wishing her good luck on the day of her hearing.
Hi, ma'am. How are you?
Hi.
Got some lovely flowers for you. Are you Lita Sullivan?
Yeah, I'm Lita Sullivan.
Lita Sullivan is shot at point-blank range with a 9mm pistol. She's left to die in the foyer.
There was a neighbor of Ms. Sullivan's. He looked over and saw a person running from the residence. After the person vacated the property, he went into her house and then discovered her lying in the foyer, covered in blood.
A soon-to-be ex-wife murdered on the day of her divorce settlement. Police immediately turned to her husband.
The first suspect that came to mind was James Sullivan because of the lengthy, bitterly contested divorce that he and Lita were going through.
But the neighbor's description of the fleeing gunman doesn't sound anything like Sullivan. What's more, he has an ironclad alibi. At the time of the murder, he was living it up 600 miles away.
Sullivan had an alibi. He was here in Palm Beach having dinner when it happened.
But that doesn't mean he couldn't have hired someone else. Investigators start digging into Sullivan's past and discover a cloud over his inheritance. Turns out, the benevolent uncle who left him a $5 million ticket to Palm Beach died under suspicious circumstances.
He was always a suspect in the uncle's death. They thought that he had poisoned him. There's a document produced that the uncle signed everything over to him. Shortly after that, the uncle's passed away.
Did Sullivan murder to get his fortune and to keep it, too? His ex-wife's death certainly saved him a lot of money. The police have enough evidence to warrant a phone tap. And it pays off quickly.
Sullivan called a neighbor of Lita's, asking if he had seen anything unusual. Well, that's unusual in and of itself. Why would Sullivan want to know from a neighbor if he saw anything unusual?
A look back through Sullivan's phone records yields a telltale trace.
There was a collect phone call made from a payphone 40 minutes after the murder to Sullivan's house here in Palm Beach. And that payphone was about a 40-minute drive from the murder along the interstate.
Could this have been the hitman calling to say that the job was done? Then investigators hit pay dirt. Sullivan makes a grave mistake, telling a friend his wife was shot with a 9mm handgun.
He says she was shot with a 9mm. Yeah, that's right, a 9mm weapon.
That information was what we consider holdout information and was not released to anybody other than the investigative team.
Yeah, it's really messed up my life.
Cops knew that only the shooter or the killer would know the caliber of the weapon. That was another nail he was putting in his freedom coffin.
Atlanta authorities want to bring a murder for hire case against Sullivan, but they know the phone evidence alone won't be enough for a conviction. So they bide their time. Meanwhile, with Sullivan's ex-wife out of the picture, he can marry his new wife and keep his Palm Beach dreams alive.
Just get out of the car, follow me.
Or can he?
Jim Sullivan was involved in a minor traffic accident in West Palm Beach, Florida. And at that particular time, his license was revoked. So he told Suki Rogers to tell the police that she was driving the car.
Did Sullivan ask his wife to lie for him?
He convinces her to stand up in front of the judge and say that she was driving. So that was perjury.
Suki is not charged, but Sullivan is, for perjury, and gets 1 year's house arrest. She's had enough.
All you think about is space and money.
But there's worse to come.
You need to give some of it up, buddy, because I love divorce.
Sullivan confesses to Suki that he killed his ex-wife, according to her later court testimony. In November 1990, she files for divorce, then goes straight to the police. This is the break investigators have been waiting for. With Suki's testimony, they can finally bring the murder conspiracy case against Sullivan.
She testifies that he once threatened her that the same thing was going to happen to her that happened to Lita.
Suki said that he had told her that he had had Lita murdered.
But when the trial comes, it's a case of his word against hers.
In the trial of a multimillionaire, an ex-wife witness is no match for a Top Gun lawyer. The argument goes like this. An ex-wife wants money. An ex-wife is bitter. An ex-wife can't be trusted. The court buys it. And in June 1992, James Sullivan walks free.
In Palm Beach, there are often two standards of justice, one for the wealthy and one for the rest of us.
It just showed the power of having a good attorney and being able to pay powerful attorneys to keep you out of jail. That was the bottom dollar. If you're rich, you can get away with a lot.
6 long years later, in 1998, Georgia authorities get a new break in the Lita Sullivan case. After seeing a TV story about the murder, an informant comes forward.
We had a confidential source at that particular time that lived in Texas, and she was the former girlfriend of Tony Harwood.
The informant says her ex-boyfriend, furniture delivery man Tony Harwood, once bragged about being hired by a Palm Beach millionaire to kill his wife in Atlanta. Investigators chase the lead.
We secured the arrest warrant for Tony Harwood and went to his residence in Albemarle, North Carolina, to arrest him.
Harwood confesses and blows the whistle on James Sullivan in exchange for a plea bargain.
He gave up James Sullivan's name as being the person that hired him. He said that he was moving his furniture from Macon, Georgia to West Palm Beach, and Sullivan approached him in the mansion about having his wife taken care of, and that he was willing to pay $25,000.
Although Sullivan has already been cleared of the charge, detectives can still make a new case. One problem, Sullivan has already left the country.
We were able to show through records that he had gone to Costa Rica. He owned a home there for a while. He thought he was safe from extradition. Then he went to Venezuela for a short period and then off to Thailand.
Sullivan is a fugitive. For the next 4 years, he hides in 7 different countries before the law finally catches up to him.
It was not until 2 agents from a Thai police agency that were training at the FBI Academy saw his picture. When they went home, he was identified and living in this condo community in Thailand.
He sat in a Thai prison for a couple of years before he was brought back here and then tried for the murder here.
In 2006, Sullivan goes on trial for murder, with Tony Harwood as the key witness.
Sullivan sends his A-list lawyers into battle again. But even his high-priced legal talent can't shake off the facts this time. James Sullivan is convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life without parole.
Finally, justice was served. A very cunning, selfish man, finally placed in a cage where he belonged to be.
He belongs in hell, but that's down the road.
In Atlanta, Georgia, the result is small consolation for Lita's family. Jim Sullivan's deadly social ambition and lust for wealth took their beloved daughter from them. No amount of jail time will change that.
For most of his adult life, Jim Sullivan tried to break into the Palm Beach establishment. In the end, they wouldn't even allow him into the Palm Beach prison. He will spend the rest of his life in Reidsville Penitentiary, Georgia, where the society he craved so much could not be further out of reach.
Coming up, behind mansion walls. They say love conquers all. But in Palm Beach, there's one thing that trumps love every time. Greed.
You don't give me what I want.
I want a divorce.
I'm gonna come and shoot everyone.
This program contains dramatizations. Viewer discretion is advised. Palm Beach was founded on money. Standard Oil money built the first resorts here at the turn of the last century. And for over 100 years, Palm Beach has been the preferred address for the best clubs, the best restaurants, and the best parties. But not everyone here chooses to indulge in high society's favorite pastimes. In the 1990s, one resident sits on the sidelines.
He absolutely did not participate in the social scene. And despite having an enormous amount of money from business, he was essentially a miser. He drove older cars, he ate in very inexpensive restaurants, dressed in very basic clothes.
His name is Fred Keller. And in a town where charity donations start at six figures, this Scrooge stands in stark contrast.
You're talking about a man who bragged about tipping the barber a nickel.
Fred started with nothing and made his money in real estate.
Fred got rich from the dull end of the real estate market. Warehouses and offices. Nothing flashy, but massive earners, just like Fred.
His net worth in real estate was approximately $100 million.
But you don't make $100 million by simply being a nice guy. Fred is known as a street fighter. Some say he would battle his own grandmother in court for a buck. It's just the way he does business.
Fred was a very ruthless business person, was suing everybody, very litigious.
What time? 3 o'clock? Buying cheap properties, manipulating people, driving people out, ugly businessman.
Fred Keller's millions have not bought him happiness. After a lifetime of hard bargains, he's growing old, is in the early stages of leukemia, and he's lonely. He's desperately seeking an attractive young wife to take care of him and to provide him with an heir before he dies.
Fred met his women through putting ads in the newspaper or magazines saying, rich Palm Beach millionaire, you know, seeks younger woman.
He's already been married to four different women. Now he's looking for number five.
He was a proud German. That's why he placed a personal ad for a nice German girl in a German magazine.
His father was pro-Nazi. He taught his son that Germans were superior, and Fred believed every word of it.
In the spring of 1992, a love letter arrives with a German postmark. 23-year-old Rose Kyle is everything he'd hoped for. And for this German Rose, Palm Beach Fred is her ticket out of poverty.
Rose came from this little town in Germany. She was looking for a way to get out of that little town, out of that life, to find a rich older man and move on.
On March 26, 1992, Rose arrives in Palm Beach with nothing but the clothes on her back. But she knows that life with Fred Keller will change all that.
Rose came to the United States in response to the personal ad, expecting to stay 2 weeks. She never went home to Germany.
Fred confides to her that he has leukemia and perhaps not long to live. She doesn't seem to mind.
Both were interested in having a child, and they were married, I think, within 3 or 4 months.
3 years later, the Kellers have a little boy. Fred is so besotted with his new family, he even lets Rose in on his business affairs.
Fred tried to bring Rose into the business. Rose was quite bright and was interested in becoming part of the business.
Good, darling.
At home and at the office, Rose is doing everything right. So Fred rewards her.
He started giving her 10% of every new property he would buy in his business. She thought, wasn't that wonderful?
The generosity extends to Rose's brother Wolfgang when Fred offers him a job in the firm.
Yes.
Wolfgang Kyle was the younger brother of Rose, and she had brought Wolfgang Kyle over from Germany to get an education. And while he was living here, Fred Keller took a liking to Wolfgang and started to teach him the real estate business.
We need to turn.
For a while, it's one big happy family.
We have a courtyard on both sides.
Fred is content with his beautiful wife, his son, and a hard-working brother-in-law he can trust. But Rose wants more. She insists on being an equal partner in Fred's business.
Fred got tired of the requests and took her into the office one day and scrawled out a piece of paper saying, "Okay, Rose, you're a 50% owner of the business."
Rose must be a special girl. The man who tips a nickel has just handed her $50 million. What magic has she worked to turn Scrooge into a softie? It's an old story.
She had the right size breasts, and she said immediately, "I love you, Fred."
And she's given Fred the perfect male heir he wanted. But Rose still isn't satisfied. Having millions isn't enough for her. She wants to flaunt it.
Rose! What are you doing in that dress?
I am going to...
Rose wanted to go out to these balls and become part of the Palm Beach social life.
Rose once lived a humble life in a small German village. Now she's on the Palm Beach cocktail circuit. This transformation isn't quite what Fred has in mind.
Take that dress off right now and make me dinner. I don't want to hear any more about it.
He longs for the small town girl he married, a stay-at-home mom who cook and clean.
Fred was a traditionalist, and he felt the mother of his child should be home, taking care of the child, and he became very controlling over her.
Just what's going on here? Where's his homework? Where's his math?
But the hard-headed business tycoon meets his match in Rose Kyle. She walks out on him, files for divorce, and demands half his fortune.
Seven years after Rose brightened his life, Fred is back where he started, a lonely old millionaire dying of leukemia. At least now he has an heir, and he still has his fortune. Rose thinks she'll walk away with 50 million, but she's forgetting another document she signed, the prenup.
When I read the prenuptial between Fred and Rose, I thought I'd read it wrong. I read it twice, I read it three times, because Rose in a divorce would get absolutely nothing.
Fred's legal team assures him that his money is safe, but Rose's attorneys have found a potential loophole.
The prenuptial agreement gave Fred Keller the power to give Rose Keller gifts, and that she could keep the gifts that he gave her.
And one of those gifts, Rose's lawyers argue, is the 50% stake in Fred's business.
Such a crushing defeat because Fred litigated with everybody that he came into contact with, and he always won. Rose Keller was the first person who was able to beat him at his own game.
It's a huge coup for Rose. She came from rural Germany with no money and an eighth grade education. But she learned from the master. And now she owns half the master's empire.
Rose begins as a supposedly innocent young woman. She became the new Fred Keller, just as manipulative, just as sneaky, willing to do whatever she had to do to get whatever she wanted.
Dividing up the assets won't be easy. Somehow, the two warring parties have to reach an agreement.
There had to be a series of meetings to divide this real estate fortune, the various buildings.
And according to Fred, his ex-wife is playing hardball.
Fred claimed that Rose had called Fred one night and said, if you don't give me what I want, I'm going to come into the business and shoot everyone. He began to become afraid of Rose.
Fred claims he fears for his life. He sends a fax to the Palm Beach police, warning them about Rose's threat. And it's not the only precaution he takes.
He began carrying a gun.
Tensions are high when Fred meets Rose and Wolfgang to discuss splitting the company.
Can I have some coffee for you?
And before that day is over, one of them will be dead. Amid the many heirs to great fortunes on the shores of Palm Beach, Fred Keller is a self-made man. Through sheer cunning and ruthlessness, he has built a $100 million empire. But eventually, he's outfoxed at his own game.
And it's not just anybody. It's his soon-to-be ex-wife, Rose Keller. The penniless young girl Fred brought from Germany to the high life of Palm Beach is about to take half his fortune, $50 million.
I want a divorce.
That's a lot of money to lose. When an individual sees their self-worth as their power, money, and control.
Fred Keller has warned police that his ex-wife Rose has threatened him with violence, but there are assets to divide. And just a few days after the divorce decree is handed down, a meeting is called at Fred Keller's office.
Oh, well, you're on time. That's unusual for you.
Okay. We have a copy for you to see.
You have a copy.
Rose's brother Wolfgang joins the estranged couple.
Here is your copy.
What happens next is hotly contested by both parties. But there are a few things on which everyone agrees. There was a gun, a violent struggle, three shootings, and a death in Palm Beach. Wolfgang calls the cops.
The arriving police officers didn't really know who had done what to whom, but they knew that they had one dead person, one very seriously injured person, and another individual who was shot.
Rose Kyle lies dead with a bullet in her neck. Wolfgang is on the floor, shot twice. He's alive. Police follow a blood trail to the office next door, where they find Fred sitting in a corner, bleeding from the head.
The two living victims victims, Fred and Wolfgang, were taken in separate ambulances to hospital. They were put in the ER room in beds, not 3 feet apart. And each man looked at the other man and said, "You've tried to kill me."
So who's telling the truth? Investigators start with the gun. It belongs to Fred. And the way he tells it, he had to use it in self-defense after mistaking Wolfgang's cell phone for a weapon.
He said, "When Wolfgang sat down, I saw him put down what I believed to be a gun." Fred said, "I became frightened and believed that Wolfgang was there to kill me."
Fred says he shot Wolfgang as a preemptive strike, but he struck back. And in the struggle, Rose caught friendly fire. Then Wolfgang wrestled the gun away and tried to take an eye for an eye. But investigators find Fred's story suspicious. After all, who mistakes a cell phone for a gun?
He said Wolfgang picked up the cell phone and pointed it at him. Well, you pick up a cell phone, you don't point it like a gun.
Forensics determine Wolfgang was sitting down when he was shot, hardly an aggressive position. Fred says he feared for his life and told the cops in a fax. But they raise the question, did Fred invent Rose's alleged threat?
He just wanted a stupid paper trail to give justification for what he was planning to do.
The police immediately arrested Fred, despite his assertion of innocence.
Fred goes on trial for murder. Assistant State Attorney Andrew Slater is assigned to the prosecution. Armed with a strong case, he has no way of knowing the twist that's coming.
I remember thinking initially, well, murder in an office, they've caught him, they've got a surviving victim, gonna be an easy case. Well, it turned out to be a little bit more complicated than that.
She's a beautiful young wife who makes an old millionaire very happy for a time.
You're not hanging around with those Palm Beach phonies that you call your friends.
After having their child and a successful business partnership, things go south.
I want a divorce.
I see it often on the social circuit. At first, they're lighting up the pages of Vanity Fair and Quest magazine. Later, they're hiding from The Star and Us Weekly. But millionaire divorces don't get much messier than this.
On January 20th, 2005, property mogul Fred Keller stands trial for murdering his wife, Rose, and shooting her brother, Wolfgang. The prosecution thinks they have a strong case. When it comes to motive, Fred Keller had 50 million reasons to take Rose out of his life.
Fred believed that if he could eliminate Rose, that he could eliminate the divorce decree, which gave half of everything that he owned to Rose.
We have a copy for you to see.
Wolfgang Kyle takes the stand and tells the court about the fateful meeting between him, his sister, and her ex-husband.
The meeting had hardly begun when Fred pulled out his gun.
In Wolfgang's version, Fred Keller was the true aggressor. And Rose's death was no accident. The only part Wolfgang and Fred agree on is that Wolfgang tried to take revenge.
Wolfgang thought he had actually killed Fred because he had shot him at almost point-blank range, but he actually missed him, only grazed Fred Keller.
Two survivors with two vastly different recollections. The jury has to decide who is telling the truth, the millionaire or his trophy wife's brother.
On February 2nd, 2005, the jury begins its deliberations. 3 days later, they announce a deadlock. 9 jurors are convinced Fred planned to murder Rose. But the remaining 3 keep asking themselves one question. Why would a man worth $100 million risk losing it all by resorting to murder?
They find it hard to believe that. So when they heard any kind of possible explanation, like Wolfgang taking a phone off and putting it on the table, that that's why Fred did it, they want to believe that, yeah, that makes more sense than a millionaire wanting to kill somebody.
It's a hung jury, a mistrial. Fred Keller walks free. But prosecutors keep on the case, and 2 years later, in January 2007, they get a new trial. This time, they attempt to sway the jury with tales of Keller's miserly behavior. This millionaire, they say, would sooner kill than lose a dime.
If anybody threatened his money, if the only thing he could do was kill them in order to preserve his money, he would do that.
It works. This jury comes to a very different conclusion. The cell phone story is a lie. This time, it takes the jury just 5 hours to return a guilty verdict. Fred is sentenced to life without parole. But the question remains, why would a man with a terminal illness murder for money he could never spend?
Fred Keller knew that he was dying of leukemia, and it was more a matter of, she's not gonna beat me, she's not gonna live the rest of her life enjoying my money.
Miserly to the end, Fred Keller has one more grudge to settle. With Rose dead, her family stands to inherit half his fortune, and he'll do anything to stop it. He appeals his case.
One of his lawyers told him that if he died while the case was still in appeal, that his deceased wife's family would not get any money out of the estate. So a light bulb went off in his head, he stopped taking his medicines, and he let himself die very quickly.
But Fred's premature death turns out to be for nothing. Despite his appeal, Fred's inheritance is passed on over his dead body. In the end, the empire of wealth Fred Keller spent his life making and ended his life to protect was broken up and given away. Every last brick and dollar. Wolfgang and the Kyle family received a little over $10 million. The rest went to Rose and Fred's orphaned son.
One can't help but wonder, when he learns where his fortune comes from and what it did to his parents, will he want to have anything to do with it? Fred Keller and James Sullivan, two working-class men driven by greed. Starting with nothing, they had everything to gain. But when they'd got it all, the millions, the mansion, the beautiful wife, they threw it all away. Money gave them glamorous new lives, but there's nothing glamorous about death. Not even death in Palm Beach. Till next we meet, behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.